Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Thursday. Going to talk some USC Trojan football today with our buddy, our pal, Shotgun Spratling. Does a great job covering the team and recruiting over at USCFootball.com. He'll join us here in a couple of minutes. I want to talk a little bit first about kind of what we're going to do. So today's show, a lot of questions have come in that were just kind of not for Harvey Hyde, not for Dan Weber. Usually they just come to me, do a solo show. So Shotgun's going to come in a little bit early. We normally do our Thursday live show at noon, which we're going to do today on Facebook Live. But he came in a little early. We're going to answer some of the questions that were kind of left over, lots of team stuff from the championship game, from everything. So we're going to do our best to get to all those. You guys have sent in a ton. So I'm going to try to wipe all those out and get all of your questions answered. And it won't be just me today. It'll be Shotgun Spratling. If you have any questions or comments, podcast@uscfootball.com. Or you can call or text us at 424-254-9141. That's 424-254-9141. We're also on all the social media aspects. You can follow me at Inside Troy. You can subscribe on iTunes, itunes.com/Peristyle Podcast. So very cool stuff. We love it when you subscribe. We love it when you send us some positive feedback. And, of course, a five-star rating that helps propagate the show. Before we jump into all of that, I wanted to thank our sponsor, Blue Apron. So it's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredibly home-cooked meals accessible to everyone. So all of the animals, beef, chicken, pork, come from reasonably raised animals. They ship the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe. So there's no food waste. So they send you everything you need. And there's this beautiful cardstock, full colored, both sides. It'll show you what the dish should look like, what the ingredients that were sent, some of the knickknacks that you included, like different spices and stuff. And then step-by-step instructions on the back showing you exactly what you should be doing. So if you're not a great cook, it shows you, hey, this is where you put it in the pot. This is what you're doing. This is how you cut up the vegetables. So it's pretty cool stuff. What I like to do is make these meals every once in a while. We actually have a couple on order I'm waiting for right now. The last one we did was a spicy Korean-style chicken, which is really cool. It looks impressive. So if you want to cook for your husband, your wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever it is, check it out because it's a really impressive-looking meal. And you look at the ingredients. You know, I'm looking at the picture. You look at the ingredients. It's simple. You had boneless skin on chicken thighs, a potato, some red cabbage scallions, and gnocchi mushrooms, which I didn't know what those were, but they go by the name golden needle mushroom. So they were pretty cool. And some spices. You take that, like those simple ingredients, and when you cook it all up, it's this beautiful looking dish, with the purple from the cabbage and the potatoes and a really nice reddish tint to the chicken with the sauce and everything. So it's a really cool looking dish. And so if you want to go check out this week's menu on blueapron.com, you will get $30 off your first order with free shipping. So go to blueapron.com/peristyle. That's blueapron.com/peristyle. You'll love how good it feels, tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/peristyle. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now it's making me hungry. I haven't eaten this morning. And now I'm just thinking about the Blue Apron meals that we've made. So definitely I would check it out if you like to do home-cooked stuff, but you're not maybe the great chef. Or even if you are, it's great that it all comes in one package, exactly what you need. Plus you get $30 off. So, and free shipping. Hard to beat. That's a great deal. We had one voicemail I wanted to play. I'll just answer myself before Shotgun kind of runs in here. This was sent a little while ago, but I wanted to address it. So here you go.
Hey, Ryan, this is Jeff from Orange County. Just want to let you guys know that I love your podcast, and I really respect your opinions, which is why it's really tough for me to accept your opinion that USC should not go to the playoff. And it's tough for me to hear you say that not only should they not go, but you don't want USC to go to the playoff. I absolutely think we should go to the playoff. At this point, it looks like we'll probably play in the Fiesta Bowl against either Wisconsin or Ohio State. I guess my question is, what's the difference between playing Wisconsin or Ohio State in the Fiesta Bowl or playing Wisconsin or Ohio State in the college football playoff? I'd rather play in a college football playoff against one of them than the Fiesta Bowl. I know you're saying, well, you're afraid that we're going to get beat down in college football playoff. Well, you know what? I'm afraid we're going to go to the Fiesta Bowl and get beat down by one of those teams. All the schools in the top 10 right now, it's kind of a crapshoot. Any one of the four schools from the top 10 could go to the playoff. And you know what? It's kind of a free-for-all. You throw USC in there, and it's a free-for-all as well. USC could very well win the championship along with, you know, say, Wisconsin, Ohio State, Auburn. They're all pretty equal, in my opinion. Okay, thanks again, Ryan. Take care.
Jeff in Orange County, thanks for the question. And, yeah, okay, so I wouldn't say afraid. I'm not afraid of it. Like, I'm not playing. I'm not afraid of anything. I just – my thought was for this team, the way they've been playing – the way they're made up, it probably would be better for the overall growth of the team to go to a Fiesta Bowl and maybe have a more winnable game than go into the playoff. As it turns out, you're going to the Cotton Bowl. They're playing Ohio State like you thought they might play, which a lot of people thought. And, you know, certainly that's a team with a lot of athletes. You want to talk about people that complain about the way USC's playing. They just out-athlete people. It's going to be hard to out-athlete Ohio State. You know, it's certainly a great matchup. And certainly, like you said, there's potential for a beatdown there. Ohio State's favored by a touchdown going into the game. I think sneaking in at number four, I knew whoever was going to be number one, it was going to be a tough matchup. And I think playing Clemson is going to be a lot tougher than playing Ohio State. Now, USC has enough horses that they could make a run and run the table and do some really good things. I mean, that's certainly possible. We just haven't seen them really play that way. So my whole point was, you know what, like last year not making the championship game was actually a good thing if you talk to, you know, some of the people inside, because the USC team was so beat up, they likely go to the championship game and lose. Now, do you ever want to not go to the championship game? No, you shouldn't. But last year, probably better that you didn't. And you sneak into the Rose Bowl and you win the Rose Bowl and everything feels good. I think the season feels a lot different if you go to the championship game and lose, because the team's all beat up and everything. So I think it just kind of worked out better last year. Going to the Rose Bowl was like the greatest thing, right? I just felt it would kind of work out better this year if you win the Pac-12 championship, which they did, and that's the big part, then and go and play a tough team in the Fiesta Bowl, or, you know, in this case, the Cotton Bowl, and get a victory that way. So that's just kind of the way I felt it would go. I understand. You're USC. You want to make the playoff as often as possible. I just felt like maybe it's not the best thing for this team this year. They certainly could still get blown out in the Cotton Bowl against Ohio State. Then where are you sitting? I think it's a positive that you won the Pac-12. And the people that poo-poo that, I just don't get it, because USC hadn't won since 2008. So the last time USC won the Pac-12 was with Pete Carroll. You know, you remember that? Like, seems like ages ago. Well, that's the last time USC won the Pac-12. And the Pac-12 South had never won that game. So to me, it was a very important step for USC this year to win the Pac-12 South. And I think once you have a brand new head coach that doesn't have any experience, do you want to be learning on the job at USC? No, but USC hired someone that was going to have to learn on the job. So I don't know if it could have worked out much better than winning the Rose Bowl, you know, in that first year, winning the Pac-12 the next year, with everyone's like, hey, well, you didn't win the Pac-12. Well, now he's done that. And if you're able to beat an Ohio State in the Fiesta Bowl, the resume for Clay Helton, all the people that are down on him, and, you know, look, I was very from the beginning, USC should have went out and got a bigger name. I was not on board with this, but he's the head coach now, and like, I'm not going to ignore, just because I didn't agree with the hiring, I'm not going to ignore what he's done. Yes, they've looked crappy in a lot of games, and they didn't play up the potential and all that kind of stuff, but if you're able to go 12-2, like, that's pretty darn good. You're Pete Carroll kind of territory, and it sets you up for, you know, maybe making a run next year, especially if Sam Darnold ends up coming back. So, Jeff at OC, I get what you're saying. I'm just looking at, if I'm like a general manager, like if you do like a Herm Edwards thing and you're hiring like a general manager of your college football program, I think if you were planning it, the way it ended up last year after starting 1-3, probably it couldn't have gone any better, obviously. And I think it would have been better. I mean, yes, if you go to the Pac-12 championship game and win, it's a little bit better. But it just, the way the team was beat up, I just don't think it was going to happen. And then this year, I just felt like, yeah, I'm not sure that it would be best to go and get shut out or something against Clemson in the first round. That's all I'm saying. Now, it's not good to go and get beat up by Ohio State either, but I think that's a much more winnable game. I think the spread would be a lot closer against Ohio State than it would be against Clemson. All right, well, let's welcome in Shotgun Spratling. Follow him on Twitter at ShotgunSPR. He's in studio a little bit early, coming early, so we can do our live show a bit. But he wanted to, so I don't have to answer all the questions by myself. We'll get Shotgun in here.
Yeah, I just figured it'd be nice, come in, help you out, give you a little reprieve. You know, I know you've been, you know, having to listen to everything. Jana's yelling about Tennessee and probably yelling, stop, stop, I don't want to hear anymore. So, you know, give your voice a little bit of rest. So I'm coming to help out.
Yeah, well, it's not a rest day, but yes, it looks like the Tennessee coaching search is finally over. I spent the morning scraping popcorn off the ceiling in my closets. Are you much of a like handy guy? I'm not real handy, but I'm like doing all the stuff in the house now.
I am not. I'm like the exact opposite of my dad. My dad is super handy. My girlfriend hangs out with my dad. They do like arts and crafts projects together when they're in the same city together. Whereas I'm like, can we just pay somebody real quick because I'm busy? I got three jobs, so I'm trying to get from one job to the next, so I don't have time to be handy all the time. But the good thing is, you can always just YouTube everything. You can figure out how to be handy. So if I had time, I would be more handy. But because of my schedule, I'm not usually the most handy person.
Yeah, I try. Like I YouTube a lot of stuff, but like we're redoing our closets, and I've, you know, popcorn had scraped off all of our ceilings in the house, and but in the closet, that was still there. So I've scraped popcorn off two ceilings now, and they're like covered with dust this morning. But it's cool. It's all good now.
Popcorn ceilings are always difficult. That's a thing from the 80s and early 90s that I don't know why was a big thing. We still have, I think, in my house back in Georgia. So, you know, I don't know why my dad was like, this is a great idea. And he's just too lazy now to be up on a ladder to be trying to take care of everything now. But if I was to be home for more than a week, it might be like, hey, can you just go ahead and scrape all that off? Like, I feel like I might get that task handed down to me.
Yeah, it's it's no fun, but luckily it was small. I didn't have to do like the whole ceiling, just like inside the closet, so it wasn't too bad. All right, well, let's jump in, answer some of these questions. We got a ton, so we'll try to go through them quickly. Tarek with a Q, he said, can someone explain David Shaw being named Coach of the Year in the Pac-12? He called it the Package 12, but the Pac-12. Well, while USC play wasn't great, Coach Helton had a better record than Shaw. The team had a higher ranking. Helton beat Shaw twice in the same year and won the conference championship. I don't see on what grounds the conference has to name Shaw Coach of the Year.
I mean, when you get a Coach of the Year, it almost always is, hey, it's the guy that wins. The guy that wins the whole thing.
Yes.
You know, this guy, obviously, you won the championship of whatever league, conference, you know, the entire nation. That's how you win. Or your team really overachieved from the expectations and, you know, the talent that you may have. David Shaw didn't really do either of those.
No.
I mean, they have talent. Hey, they had some injuries. Bryce Love got nicked up. They won through all those games. You lost to San Diego State early in the year with some, you know, when the lights went out and everything. You lost to USC twice. Yeah, that doesn't make too much sense.
No.
Should Clay Helton necessarily have been the Coach of the Year? Not necessarily. He could be a candidate. And again, it's because he has a team that won the championship, then he should be one of the guys you look at. But you also look at like a team like Mike Leach, you know, at Washington State, a team that, you know, was not in the top 25 coming into the year. I think the reason why Clay Helton is not the slam dunk pick is because USC started number four. You know, they're no longer number four, so they dropped.
But four to eighth, you know, it's like.
Yeah, but. I mean, he's one of the options. You go one or two routes. You don't go the in-between route, which is apparently what the Pac-12 did. I don't know. I didn't understand that one either. I mean, me and you both were in agreement on Twitter about how weird that selection kind of was.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of people. I'm going to put something in the war room, actually. A lot of Pac-12 reporters about this. No one would have picked David Shaw. John Wilner wrote a column and mentioned like five coaches, did not even mention David Shaw. So it's more of a, yeah, he's been the best coach over maybe the last 5 years. you know, if you want to argue Mike Leach, he beat both Shaw and Helton. But Helton beat Shaw heads up twice. And they, if you watch Stanford, people are like, oh, they were well coached. They were not well coached this year. No. I watched them a lot. They didn't play KJ Costello when they should have. They should have lost to Oregon State. They won by a point. Bryce Love was out, but David Shaw didn't even play his best quarterback in that game stubbornly. Like, he was asked at halftime, like, hey, are you going to put in Costello? Because he's been doing that. And he was given this smirk. Like, he was trying to prove, no, I can win with the guy I want to win with. He almost lost the game because of being stubborn.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense. I mean, if you only beat Oregon State, this Oregon State team this year by one point, yeah, that should just be automatic, you know, elimination from that consideration for me. Because they were very, very, very bad this year. And even, you know, after they made the coaching change, there was not a ton of talent there. No. And I think Ryan Nall
I don't think he played in that game. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you beat them by one? Are you kidding me?
Yeah. No, that was Oregon State's best game of the year. So there's no way. Like, Shaw should not have won. I'm not saying Helton should have won. Shaw should not have won.
Do you mean there's other candidates? You could go with Rich Rod. You could go with Todd Graham.
Todd Graham, who got fired. Yeah.
Those teams overachieving from maybe the expectations earlier in the year. You know, even like Oregon and Cal, those teams, like Cal was a team that no one expected to do anything. They were winning some games early, kind of, you know, dropped off at the end of the year. But, you know, those coaches should have been more consideration, in my opinion, than David Shaw. You know, David Shaw and Chris Peterson both kind of should have been eliminated because you're supposed to be competing for the title and you didn't win it.
Yeah.
If you're one of those teams that, hey, going in, you're like, these are the top two or three teams. If you don't win it, then you should. That kind of should be an elimination for Coach of the Year.
Yeah, I thought it was bogus. So back to that. We have a text question. Hey, Ryan, Coach, Dan. Looking forward to an awesome opportunity versus Ohio State, but I was wondering if anyone has really talked to underclassmen about not leaving for the NFL. Just looking at last year's combine, the Trojans didn't really impress much, and the only ones making an impact in the NFL would be Adoree and Juju. I believe these kids need to stay and polish their own games as opposed to leaving for the money right away. Your thoughts, and thanks for keeping us informed, Eric and Rosemead.
You know, last year I talked to Adoree and Juju kind of leading up to it, because you kind of knew those are the two guys. Those are fringe first-round guys. This year, you kind of expect Ronald Jones to leave. He said he was going to play in the bowl game. He wouldn't go out like that, I think is what he said by not playing, he meant. So you kind of expect him to leave, you know, especially running backs. Very good running backs usually don't make it to that senior year just because of the wear and tear factor. Besides that, you look at the other guys. Sam Darnold, you know, has been asked. We've agreed that we don't think he actually has made a decision yet. So those are the two guys that are the fringe first-round guys. Yeah. I think guys like Uchenna Nwosu, I think Rasheem Green, I think Cam Smith can all work their way up draft boards with very good combines, Rasheem Green in particular, just because I think he's been a beast that people kind of have overlooked because, you know, that guy has been playing so many snaps in games and has been contributing big things, playing kind of a hybrid defensive tackle, defensive end role. And I think if a team sees him in a particular role and he does really well at the combine, which I think he could, then I think he could really push his way up draft boards and catch the eye of a specific team and get drafted earlier than maybe some people expect. But, you know, there hasn't been really a lot of conversation with those guys necessarily about, hey, you know, what's your thinking on that? And a lot of guys aren't going to talk to, at this point. Usually leading up to the bowl season, sometimes then some guys will start talking about it a little bit. And a lot of times the decisions aren't made until after the bowl game because that's when people sit down with their families, they go through everything. Sometimes that happens during the Christmas break, but a lot of times it happens after the game and how the game goes. And somebody like Adoree, who everyone just expected, oh yeah, this guy's definitely gone. No way he's coming back. He's a first-round pick. And a lot of people, you know, Adoree, was pretty close to coming back, it seemed like, from the people you talked to around him, that it came down to. It was actually a last-minute decision for him to, you know what, I think it's best for my family for me to go ahead and go now. I don't think that there's any, guys that are in that same boat this year where, the two biggest names, those are the ones where everybody's concerned or everyone has talked about. But I think so far we don't really know much about the rest of the group. Sam Darnold's kind of a question mark. Ronald Jones, I would expect to go. The rest of them, still kind of up in the air.
Yeah, probably shouldn't, but we'll see what happens. Sometimes someone has a huge bowl game and they get a little momentum. Like, who knows? But we'll see what goes on there. Let's go. We have another text question. Love the show and all you guys do. This is for anyone. Can someone please explain to me why Jody Lewis and Jamal Cook have become sideline fixtures. So much talent, and I cannot find anyone who has an answer or even thinks they know why they can't even smell the field. Also, with Shea Patterson being granted a transfer, do you think we will go after him and finally bring him to L.A.? South Carolina Trojan fan. Probably no on the Shea Patterson thing. It looks like, you know, maybe a UCLA or a Michigan, but
yeah,
what do you think of the other stuff?
And that one could, you know, if Sam Darnold makes his intentions known a little bit earlier, then that could definitely play into that, and maybe USC does get into that mix. With Joseph Lewis, he is playing some. I mean, yeah, he even got a couple snaps in the Pac-12 championship game, which hasn't been the case, you know, most of the games recently. And most of the reason why Joseph Lewis has not got a bunch of receiver reps, he's playing special teams. You know, he's played 190 snaps this season, which is not bad for a freshman at all, total snaps. The reason why he's not getting a ton of receiver snaps is because USC has found a nice three-man rotation with Steven Mitchell, Michael Pittman, and Tyler Vaughns, and those three guys have been really productive. If three guys are being really productive, you're not really just going to start throwing extra guys in the mix. Like, right, hey, we need to, you know, that you saw at the beginning of the season when there were more guys in the mix and, you know, there wasn't consistent production and everybody was clamoring for those three guys, you know, the two younger guys to play more. Now that they've gotten their opportunity, they've made the most of it. I think Steven Mitchell's been really good all season as well. So I don't think there's any room necessarily there that, hey, we need to throw a fourth, a fifth, sixth receiver in there into that mix. Would I have liked to seen those guys get five snaps a game? I think I've kind of said that all season.
Yeah.
Guys like him, Levi Jones, you know, get them, you know, four, five snaps just a game, just kind of mix them in, get them a play or two here, just because that extra, you know, those extra opportunities help so much. Joseph Lewis, now, he's a guy that got opportunities early in the season. Didn't get a ton of balls thrown his way, but, you know, there just wasn't a ton of production. So, you know, if he caught a couple more passes, you know, if somehow he was open, Sam finds him, you know, as a second or third option, that's when you see someone's playing type start to boost a little bit more. Jamel Cook, I think we've all discussed this, is kind of, I don't think necessarily that he was ready to play cornerback. However, why in the world he wasn't on special teams is beyond me. That one is the biggest kind of mystery of the season to me.
Yes.
I mean, there are a lot of mysteries on this team. There's a lot of questions like, what are they doing? That's one of the biggest ones in the entire season is like, why is this guy who's super athletic, you know, can make plays, why are you not giving him a chance on special teams? That's the weirdest one. You know, his future with the team has got to be up in question just because
for
of the fact that, you know, he hasn't got any playing time. He's a guy from across the country. And in the last couple games, he didn't even dress up. He didn't dress for the games because, you know, Clay Helton said that he was focusing on academics. So we'll see.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is something off the field. So that's the only, I think, plausible explanation, but we'll find out. I wouldn't get too attached. I'm not guessing that you're going to see a lot more Jamel Cook in a USC uniform going forward. Not that you've seen a lot of them to begin with, but we shall see. We have another text question. Longtime listener since 2011. Only my second time sending in a question or statement. Last week, I talked about this coaching staff should be held accountable for a mediocre job this season and still believe that for 9 of the 12 games, they were either outcoached or didn't have a sufficient game plan. The team played great Friday night. The offense seemed to be clicking again like the first Stanford game. However, the same mistakes or lack of preparation continue. Not getting lined up on defense, players looking around trying to get the play while the ball is being snapped, and two corners that should never be allowed to be locked and one coverage. The best thing that happened was Jack Jones getting hurt. Whoa, that's tough. So it forced them to make a change. If we can't put up 50 and outscore Ohio State, this could be an ugly bowl. I hope some changes are made to the staff ASAP. I didn't leave his name, but that was...
That's one of those statements where you just leave it. I don't want to put my name. I've only sent in two messages, and I'm going to burn down the house real quick with this one. You know, I disagree with them not lining up and stuff. I mean, you know, I thought that they did a really good job against the Stanford offense, except for that last drive kind of where Stanford got two big plays and was able to move the ball down the field. You know, they really slowed down that rushing attack. Besides the Bryce Love long run, I think he was averaging under – I think it was 3.5 yards a carry, something like that, maybe even a little bit lower than that for the final game tally. But the one run, we saw that there were a couple of areas where a little yellow hanky could have come out for a potential flag for some holding, but there was not called. I thought the defense did a pretty good job. You know, with the Stanford attack, if you can stop the running game, you can usually stop them. And part of that is putting, you know, 8-9 guys in the box and leaving those guys on the outside. And there's a reason why KJ Costello was actually one of the most efficient deep ball throwers this season, because teams are going to load the box, force you to throw outside. And they've got a couple big targets on the outside. Yeah. And
they make plays downfield.
They're
going to
make plays, yeah. One of the biggest mistakes of the whole game was actually the ball that Marvell Tell kind of overruns and allows them to get that touchdown before halftime.
Yeah, he was in great position.
Yeah, and people want to, I'm sure there are people blaming Jack Jones for that because he was there. Jack Jones is playing that perfectly. He's playing the outside coverage like he's supposed to, knowing he's got a safety in the middle, and the safety didn't make the play.
Yeah.
I think Jack Jones, I mean, what else happened in that game really against him? I mean, he got called for a pass interference when he got mugged.
Yeah.
So if you're complaining about Jack Jones in that game, I can understand the UCLA, the Colorado game. He was not very good in either one of those games. I thought Isaiah Langley came in and did a really good job until that final drive. He gave up a deep ball.
Yeah.
He was in pretty good position for that, too. Sometimes you just got to give the offense a little bit of credit,
right,
you know, that they make a play. And, you know, I thought the two throws over the middle, Caden Smith, I thought those were tremendous catches from the Stanford tight end. Nobody's like, why is Cameron Smith not covering him better? Oh, well, because, you know, he had good coverage on it. And he made a nice catch. The same thing with Ajene Harris on the second catch. Those are just very nice plays. So I don't think that the defense could get a ton of blame for this, especially after you make a fourth down stop on the sixth play inside the 10-yard line.
Yeah.
I mean, that was such a tremendous stop by them. And Josh Fatu actually told me, he's like, yeah, I was surprised too. Because they had actually, you know, they got down right before halftime and been able to, you know, basically just ran the ball in on two plays. You know, they just showed their, you know, their strength on their offensive line. That was, you know, USC was able to find a way to beat them on the goal line at their game. And it was kind of interesting when I'm looking back through the game plan. USC did a lot of Stanford things, a lot of two tight end sets.
Yeah.
Most they'd used all season. They used the pistol more than they had all season. You know, they went under center more than they had all season. So a lot of things that Stanford does, USC kind of went to their game and said, hey, we can beat you at your own game. They did it.
Yeah. Costello completed 10 passes. So it's not like, you know, there were some big passes, but he only completed 10. Robin in Virginia is an interesting one. He wants to know, do you think USC could have made the playoff or would have made the playoff if Juju and Adoree came back?
Ooh, yes.
I think they win, beat Washington State, and then it'll be closer against Notre Dame, and they go to the playoff. So I think it's pretty simple, yeah.
Yeah, and
they're not going to lose any games because they came back.
And you have to think that the Notre Dame game, you know, those first couple throws are one-on-one coverage. Maybe it's Adoree versus, you know, one of the other guys. Maybe he bats down one of those. That was the big thing. Wimbush hit a couple plays early in that game, and then it kind of turned the tide completely because USC had to, you know, back away a little bit in those one-on-one coverages and give a little help. So, you know, it could have been a completely different season. And I think you don't have as many receiver issues early in the season. So I think you can play Juju and then you say, hey, we'll give Tyler Vaughns and Michael Pittman a little bit more time early just because we know we can rely on the other side with Juju. So then maybe that Wazoo game, you know, there could have been a lot different in that. But, hey, that's the life of college football. Your best players are usually not going to be around then full time.
Yeah, good one, Robin. Tyler in Sammamish, it seems clear to me, and I believe you said this as well, that an 18 playoff is an absolute must. The five conference champs plus three others. So the conference championship games, a mid-December first round, New Year's Day second round, and then the championship game. How much tweaking of the regular season would have to happen for this to happen? Seems like there would need to be a later start to the season, eliminating one of the lower profile non-conference games in order to make a mid-December game reasonable. While I'm a traditionalist at heart, I realize that clearly those days are gone, but an eight-team, every conference championship game winner at least maintains the importance of conference regional games. Tyler and Sammamish.
The problem with an eight-team playoff is that you're starting to stretch the limits of what a college football season can be in one semester, for one, because then you're pushing it to, oh, let's get that second, you're getting a second game in January where teams are playing twice. Now you're starting the spring semester while you're still playing football. And the fact that you have 11, 12 regular season games, or a 13 sometimes with a Hawaii game, and then you had a conference championship game, you had, you know, three rounds of playoffs then, you know, you can get up to 16 games, 17 games there. That's as much as a professional NFL player is playing. So
that's a lot of games.
That's a ton. That's a ton of time commitment as well for the players. What you would have to do, in my opinion, to get to an 18 playoff, and what I think should be done, is you equalize the schedule. Every conference plays eight conference games, three non-conference games. And then, you know, if you want to do, David Shaw had the perfect quote that I think it was Kyle Bonagura tweeted it out from ESPN that, you know, that said basically, hey, you have to equalize the scheduling there where you play, everybody plays one group of five, everybody plays, you know, one power five, and you can have a rivalry game or whatever. You know, that makes it even for all schools. Whereas right now, hey, Alabama plays, you know, a tough neutral site non-conference game early in the season, and then three cupcakes.
Yeah.
Whereas USC just played Notre Dame, Texas, and a Western Michigan team coming off of Cotton Bowl. And even if they're not any good, that's still, you know, a group of five game, and you have two power five. You know, what other teams are doing that? You're not. And then you have nine conference games where teams know you.
Yeah.
Very difficult. You have to make the schedule normal, and you have to eliminate a game. That's not going to happen because nobody wants to give up money that extra game. Because even when Auburn is playing Charleston Southern, they're still bringing in 70,000 fans to come watch it because everybody wants to tailgate and have a good time at the game.
Yeah.
And they're not going to give up that gate. That's the biggest problem. Teams are not going to say, I'll give up a game for the sake of college football. It's all about money. And if you're not making more money for the schools, then they're not going to be interested.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Let's go. We got Sergeant Rodney from Fort Lewis, Washington, U.S. Army. Can you believe it? We actually won the Pac-12 and now on to Ohio State. What do you think the chances are of Sam coming back and Rojo, or do you think they're NFL bound? We kind of talked about Rojo. Sam, like 50-50, is that, would you say?
Yeah, or? I mean, there's so many factors. I mean, I had a discussion with Bill Plaskin, a couple other writers not too long ago. And some people were like, he's got to go. He's got the opportunity. He's going to, you know, potentially get all this money as being a first-round guy. But then the other side of it is, can he still develop? Is he going to go to a team that's going to help him develop in that first year in the NFL? Or, you know, I think if he were able to get an Aaron Rodgers situation, or even Brett Hundley following Aaron Rodgers, where he could sit for a year and learn from a good quarterback, yes, he should go. I think you can develop more in the NFL that way. But is he going to be thrown into the fire and immediately say, hey, you got to save us. We're the Jets. We're the Giants. We need you in this New York market to save us. I don't think that's best for him. Can Josh Rosen do that for a team? I think so. I think he is further along in his development. I think he can make all the throws and makes the progression, reads and stuff. I think Sam, there's still things he needs to work on. The deep ball for one, making the progressions in the pocket and not trying to, you know, he's gotten a little happy feet sometimes late in the season and try to get out of the pocket a little too soon when maybe he's had other opportunities. But he also shows that all those skills are there.
Yeah.
You know, he showed, you know, that throw to Pittman, steps up in the pocket, gets hit, he's getting drilled immediately, finds his man over the middle of the field on the 1 yard, you know, on the 1 yard line or even in the end zone when he makes a throw. And he's thrown some deep balls that's shown that he has the arm strength to do it. He just has to get more consistency with that. So if he were to come back, I think he can develop, but I think that's one of the things you have to weigh as a family. Hey, do we need the money right now? Are we going to bet on ourselves that we can move up even more and be, because the thing is in the NFL, it's not about the first contract. You know, in pro sports, it's all about the second contract. Can you get to that second contract? Now, if you're, you know, especially in the NBA, you want to get there as soon as you can to get that second contract. But the NFL, with nothing guaranteed, if you flame out in 3 years, then you don't get the second contract at all. So, you know, you have to bet on yourself that you're going to be better prepared if you wait an extra year and, you know, and then you get to that big, big contract. And you get, if you're Kirk Cousins, you're getting $20 million a year. I mean, that, it changes things a lot then.
Yeah, I'm kind of leaning towards he's going to come back right now. Just maturity-wise, not about play, but for him to go into like an NFL locker room, and I think he's still kind of a kid in some aspect, which is not a bad thing, but I think he could probably use another year to grow into that. But, you know, we'll see.
Yep.
Edwin and Encino, thank you for your thank you and your amazing team that provide Trojaholics like myself real substance between games. Now the season is over and the championship is won. I was wondering if anyone has calculated the quote-unquote starting field position average for the season. Unofficially, we all know the disparity between Adoree's work a year ago and the returners this year must be great. The disparity must be great. But I would be curious to know how much. Honestly, if the number is staggering, and I'm sure it is, it shows a strength in USC's offense that people rarely talked about. How we're able to execute 80-plus yard scoring drives. Honestly, I've never seen so many long drives successfully achieved in one season. Even during the Pac-12 championship game and when our returner again pinned us back to the two, I had this calm sense of, oh, well, this is just what we do. And it seems this was the way these kids like to play. What do you attribute to so many successful long, super long drives, Edwin and Encino?
You attribute it to the fact that there's a ton of talent on this team.
Yeah.
So
not necessarily punt return talent, but talent.
I was trying to see if this was actually on the statistics. I don't think it is.
Like the average starting field
average
position.
Starting field position. However,
it's been poor though. Poor.
However, last night I did happen to look up when USC was backed up in their drives. They've had 50 drives starting at the 20 or further back. So you get the kickoff, it's a touchback. You start
50?
50.
That seems like a lot.
So they've had 18 drives starting at the 10 or farther back. Sometimes it's a good punt, sometimes it's mistakes. So of the 50 drives starting at the 20 or further, they have 15 touchdowns. That's not a bad percentage, yeah. But of the 18 drives starting at the 10 or farther back, they have 8 touchdowns. 8 of their 18 drives. That is just a phenomenal. They have 2 interceptions. They lost one on downs. They lost a fumble and 6 punts. And one of those interceptions was the Arizona State after they'd driven 97 yards and then they tossed an interception.
So they drove the whole field.
Yeah. So they have, I think it's 9 drives over 90 yards this season, or at least 90 yards. So, I mean, this team has shown that, they have explosive playmakers. They can make plays. They can make guys miss on the outside. You've seen Tyler Vaughns. You've seen Michael Pittman make plays. You guys where, if they single cover them on that side, they can go by them, or you throw them a little hitch and Tyler Vaughns, somehow no one can tackle Tyler Vaughns like right on the outside. Those quick throws to him, it seems like he makes the first guy miss every time.
He does. He breaks a tackle, which I didn't think was really a big part of his game. But
yeah.
It has been.
And coming in, we're like, oh, wow, Tyler Vaughns catches everything. Does he run by anybody? No. Does he do anything like really spectacular besides catch the ball every time? No. But you put him on the field in a game day situation, and all of a sudden guys keep slipping off of him. Yeah. And that the catch he ran in for a touchdown, I think it was like a 26-yard touchdown. He catches I think it was a 5-yard pass, and he did the rest. He made the guy miss, and
that was like a dive at the pylon too, right?
Yeah, he dove at the 4-yard line, so it just shows how long and lean he is that he's able to to extend out there. But I just thought it was pretty incredible the fact that USC. The fact they've had 50 drives at the 20 or further back is not great, but when you put them inside the 10, some reason, I tweeted it during the game. This is why I looked it up was, man, this team just seems to, it's all part of the plan. Ryan's always complaining about the punt returns and stuff. And I said, oh, it's all part of the plan. They just need to be inside the 10 to, to get focused and get going on one of those drives. And they did a couple times in that game. They were just really incredible drives, driving all the way down. That 99-yard touchdown.
That was
drive.
Like the goal line stand happens. You're like, oh, that's just like a regular punt, so it's no problem. Like, you're used to starting backed up.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why David Shaw did it, because you just figure that, hey, we can get a stop. We can, we can stop. We get the ball right back. We're in position once again. So that's why I guess he decided not to go for the field goal there to tie the game. And a lot of people were chastising him after that. But I mean, USC with they've got a 99-yard drive, 98 against Utah. Also had a 97-yard drive in that game, which kind of gets overlooked because it wasn't the 99-yard one. 93-yard against Utah, 92 against Wazoo, 91 against Oregon State, and a couple 90s against Stanford the first time and UCLA. So that's quite impressive. 8 touchdown drives of 90-plus yards this year.
Yeah, insane. Let's go Robin in Virginia. Sorry, I was trying to get all through all these. Right now, I'm seeing a lot of Saquon Barkley and Bryce Love Heisman talk by ESPN, but they are completely disregarding Rojo, who has better stats, more wins, and a conference championship. Last year, no one talked about Adoree Jackson and Ernest until the last couple of weeks. I've not seen a push by USC that I do from other schools like Stanford. USC doesn't like to push any issue, it seems, and the program suffers for it. What are your thoughts to why, and why does ESPN ignore USC players as well? I'll chime in real quick since I'm a Heisman voter. Yeah, I mean, I just think that USC was kind of all in on Sam Darnold. They did the, so Ronald Jones was definitely the better Heisman candidate this year, but he wasn't going to win it with – he needed to definitely do more. I mean, Saquon Barkley won it in September, but he fell off a lot. Bryce Love just kept doing what he was doing. It just wasn't a focus on Rojo. And I think if USC's not, like, out in front of promoting guys, like Carson Palmer wasn't even on the media guide when he won the Heisman Trophy. I mean, so he was on the cover. USC is not aggressive for that kind of stuff, but it just wasn't turned out that if someone was going to win the Heisman this year, they were going to be behind Sam.
Yeah, I don't think you can blame ESPN for this one. I mean, how much love did ESPN give to Sam Darnold at the beginning of the season?
Oh, man.
So, they were all over him then. if Sam Darnold played the same, he didn't have the turnovers, you know, if he played the same that he did late at the end of the last season, and he did that consistently, then I think even with USC's record, I think there would still be talk about Sam Darnold. But when you lose a couple games, you're going to drop down in the balloting for Heisman, because Heisman is basically the guy with the best numbers on one of the top five teams. That's basically what it's become. Yeah. You don't see, like, there's
you
can
have, like, ridiculous numbers. Like, Rojo would need to go over 2,000 yards, probably. Like, that's a magical kind of number. Do something like that, and you can get it.
Yeah, and that's not something that USC, you know, they didn't use him that way. And I don't think that they necessarily should have. I don't think he needed to have 30 carries every game, like some people thought. Because you look at some of the running backs that have come out. Leonard Fournette, I think he had 2 30 carry games in his career at LSU. Todd Gurley had a couple. You know, there's not Christian McCaffrey is kind of the difference in this talk, because he had, you know, 6 or 7 his last 2 seasons at Stanford, I think it was. So, but most times you're not going to get 30 carries out of a guy in college, and I don't think you should wear and tear them. These guys aren't Herschel Walker or Earl Campbell.
Right.
You realize that you realize how much wear and tear those guys take. You want them to have a successful career in college, and I mean in the pros. And plus, you had 4 pretty good backs for USC. You know, especially if Stephen Carr stays healthy all year, then I think Rojo doesn't even get to, you know, the 1,500 yards he's at now, or close to it, because he wouldn't have got as many carries coming down the stretch, because they want to keep both guys fresh.
Yeah. Nicholas in Charlotte, thanks for answering my question last week. Even if you and I are not seeing eye to eye on Clancy, he said our defense had a great Pac-12 game, though. I had a couple quick questions this time. First, what date does Sam Darnold and others have to announce for NFL draft day? Last year, I remember reading a certain date Adorian Juju had. This year, I can't find it anywhere. Have you heard any new rumors if Rojo State are going? We kind of talked about that. Is the date like January 15th or something?
I'm trying to find it, but I'm not exactly sure. Yeah. I mean, it has to be before they're going to start sending the combine. So the evaluations, those are usually made in December, I believe. Because it sounded like Clay Helton had those evaluations and talked with the guys before the Rose Bowl, if I remember how he kind of said. The deadline is January 16th,
okay.
I believe.
I was pretty close.
Or at least it was this past year.
Yeah, so somewhere around there.
So, yeah, in the middle of January. So usually the evaluations come maybe even before the bowl games or a week or so before that, give the players time to, you know, talk with the family and decide what they're going to do. But you have to do it before they start sending out the combine invites and stuff and start getting ready for the draft, which isn't until April.
You might see announcements early, like Matt Barkley announced, like, just before Christmas. Mm-hmm. I remember it was December 22nd because it was on my birthday. But, yeah, so sometimes they'll announce that kind of stuff. It's like mid-January is when you know. Second question, what's your opinion of Olawale Batiku? I saw a photo of the defensive team. He was the biggest guy in the photo. Should we see Batiku more next year or even in the Cotton Bowl? He seems to have the size to be groundbreaking, but unsure how he's been developed since he rarely plays. Thanks, fight on. Trojan Nation, oh, hi, no, Nicholas in Charlotte.
You know, I think Olawale Batiku still has a very bright future. I think he's only continuing to get better each and every practice. I mean, the leaps and gains that he made, the leaps and bounds of his gains from the last year are just, you know, such a big difference from when he first came in last year in the spring to now, or in the summer, excuse me, to now. You know, he's a completely different player from then. And you could say the same thing a year before that when he was in high school. He's just learning very quickly on the job. He's got so many physical attributes, but he just has not played a ton of football. And there's a lot of things, you know, and he's still having to work on his body that is not just all muscle. He's got to, you know, work on the hips and different things. And playing behind Uchenna Nwosu and seeing how he had progressed in his career, I could see a very similar career path where, you know, Olawale doesn't play a ton early in his career, but then he becomes a guy that you have to have on the field because of what he can do. You know, I think if he can get better in his hips to where he can churn and change directions a little bit better, and, you know, he's done a really good job, a much better job, I'll say, of, you know, holding the edge this year. Because last year when he would go in for the couple opportunities, you know, if they ran any kind of misdirection, he would bite going inside and they would be able to get outside, or the quarterbacks would be able to get outside. Things like that, whereas this year he's really holding that edge and doing his job on that side. I think he's just learning and progressing as the time goes by.
Yeah, you can't look at him because he looks too amazing. You're like, if you look at him, you're like, holy crap, why is he not awesome? And yeah, he hasn't been awesome yet. We'll see. Nick and Camarillo, everyone out there in the extremities of Los Angeles or wherever you are, if you're in the fire area, please be safe. We didn't mention that early on, but man, it's crazy out there. Are you close to it or no?
I'm not, you're downtown, not now. Yeah. Downtown. Previously, yeah. Where I lived in Sherman Oaks for 3-4 years, and you know that would have been a much scarier situation then. But we're hoping everybody is safe out there and. You know, don't try to do anything heroic. Get your stuff, get out.
Yeah.
Because that stuff, especially with the winds kicking up, can move so quickly. And give a fight on salute out to Anthony Reyes, the former Major League Baseball pitcher, pitched for the Cardinals, former USC Trojan, who is now a firefighter, is out there on the front line. So give him a lot of credit too, and all those firefighters throughout the job they're doing. But everyone just try to be safe out there because it can, you know, things can change so quickly with fires and how, you know, as the wind changes direction. So
yeah, we're down here at the beach and I got like an Amber Alert on my phone yesterday and I tweeted about it. I think Adam Rose tweeted it. It's like it's windy. I'm like, okay, like my windows are shut. I don't know what to do. Like there's no dangers here, but obviously there's places around Los Angeles, the South Bay. I mean the basin here that. It's a lot of danger with all the wind and everything. So, yeah, hopefully everyone's safe.
Yeah, having covered a couple, you know, fire situations, just you want to be safe, not sorry. So if they tell you to get out, make sure you do.
So we got Nick and Camarillo. Hopefully you're safe. I just heard on Paul Feinbaum on the Tony Kornheiser show. Wow, that's a blast from the past. Talking about USC and the playoff. Paraphrasing, Feinbaum said that USC essentially ruined their chances by playing Notre Dame. And if they scheduled a team like Akron that week, we'd be in the top four. We'd never drop the Notre Dame game and obviously shouldn't, but do you think it might be time to consider an easier non-conference schedule given the committee doesn't seem to care? For context, Alabama plays Louisville, Arkansas State, UL Lafayette, and the Citadel next year. There's no reason for the SEC to move to a 9-game conference schedule since they get the benefit of the doubt currently. So we're stuck challenging ourselves playing Western Michigan, Texas, and Notre Dame. USC scheduling is praiseworthy, but it seems like the wrong strategy to get to the playoff. Thoughts, Nick and Camarillo. Real quick, I agree with you, Nick, 100%. Don't drop Notre Dame. They need to have it uniform. I don't think the SEC is going to do that. There's only two conferences that haven't missed the playoff, the ACC and the SEC. Those are the two conferences that only play 8 conference games. And the Pac-12 goes an extra step by not just playing 9, but then putting all their top teams in horrible situations too. So
yeah, Pac-12 is terrible. And I think Larry Scott said, well, if this continues for like 10 years, then it becomes a trend. We'll be concerned. You should be concerned any year that you're not in the conference, in the college football playoff. Yeah, like you said, the SEC is not going to change their ways. They're not going to suddenly be like, well, we should just be more fair with everybody else and give up all this extra money that we would get from the college football playoff. You know, if USC schedules an FCS school and Ohio State schedules Akron instead of Oklahoma, then all of a sudden those two teams are the ones you're talking about instead of Alabama for that. But on the flip side, part of the reason why Ohio State got in last year, even though they were not conference champion, was because of their tough non-conference schedule.
Yes.
And the fact that they played Oklahoma.
They had 3 top 10 wins and stuff, yeah.
One of the biggest issues, and I think it's one of the biggest issues so far in the history of the college football playoff, the very short history of it, is that there hasn't been consistency.
Yes.
One year, something is important. The next year, they're like, we don't really care about that anymore.
Right.
Wait, what? I thought this was a big deal last year. So we changed this. We tried to get this neutral site game with Alabama. No, that's not important anymore. And whether it's true or not, Alabama, Nick Saban said the reason why they played Mercer is because no one else would play them.
Right. I don't buy that.
We'll see.
They have the same formula every year.
Yeah. And it's working. So why would they change?
Right. Like David Shaw won the coach of the year because of his last 5 years. Alabama got in the playoff because of their last 5 years, not for what they did this year. Because Alabama doesn't have a really good win this year, so
yeah,
you give them the benefit of the doubt because they're like it's Alabama,
and also they did schedule a team that many people were like, oh, this could be a national championship contender, right. and then they lost their quarterback. They hurt their quarterback.
Yeah.
They hurt Florida State's quarterback, and suddenly that team was no good.
But then they're garbage. Maybet in Ontario, how are the referees for bowl games picked? Thanks and beat the Buckeyes. It's different conferences. I think the Pac-12 will do the championship game because they were, but actually I don't know because the Big Ten is out too, but I think the team that's left out ends up doing the championship game. But just watch the Pac-12 refs whenever they do different bowl games, and it's awful. But you don't have the same conference. I mean, but yeah, I don't know the exact formula of how.
I don't know the formula. It's always neutral. You know.
Yeah.
You know, USC and Ohio State. There would not be Pac-12 or Big Ten referees for that.
This is Don.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, they're the worst. Don, we were all happy for SC and Helton. Then Helton opens his mouth and reminds us who he is. This doesn't sound like it's going to go well. USC overachieved. Guess Helton is full of himself now. Evidently, he was referring to the players overachieving in comparison to the coaching staff underachieving. Most likely, he was referring to team injuries, but that is part of the game. Best not to judge Helton until he is without Darnold. Hopefully, all of us critical fans are wrong. Since OSU was considered for the fourth spot, USC is getting the best team not in the playoffs. USC will be competitive? Question. Helton overachieves or a talented team which is penalty prone? Don.
I'm not exactly sure what the question is.
It's kind of all over the place.
I don't really.
Do you remember
I don't know the reference of the quote?
Yeah, it was one of the like conference calls or something. He had made some kind of reference to like USC overachieving. It definitely Scott Wolf got all over it. People were kind of all over it about, you know, and I think maybe it was having to do with no bye week and all the injuries and stuff like that. But it was a little bit strange.
This is the part of the season where before they make the selection of who was going to be in that college football playoff, you say whatever you can, for one. And I feel like that was probably in the week leading up to this because it was not on the actual bowl conference call. So, you know, if Urban Meyer would say, yeah, we've done whatever, we've overcome this and this, of course you're going to say whatever you can to try to boost your thing. You bring out all the facts that, oh, we played 12 straight weeks so that someone that's on, you know, if you have a national media member was like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. I didn't think I should consider that when I'm looking at their resume, when I'm writing about, you know, who should be involved. And then the next time, that's when the college football playoff, the committee, they've looked at this article, you know, and you feed down the line. So I don't think it was anything he said that was quite controversial just from the context that you've just given me.
Yeah. I'd have to look up exactly where, I forget where it was, but it was a little strange, but I wouldn't put too much stock into it. It's okay, people.
Yeah, I don't think Clay Helton saying that he's the best coach. I mean, he called Urban Meyer a legend, so.
Right.
He's a very self-deprecating coach in that regard. I don't think he's saying that he's overachieved with the team that he has. I would say that they know that they could have done better.
Yeah.
And probably should have done better. You know, but they also were dealt some cards that were not very favorable. You know, playing the 12 straight weeks, playing on a Friday after a bye week, which, hey, guess what? No one has won.
Yeah.
So how much blame are you going to give to a guy when no one else has been able to win in that situation either? The Notre Dame game is the biggest question mark there, I think, just the way that they, you know, kind of folded after getting behind early. I think that one's the biggest thing you can look at this season as, you know, a biggest concern. But, you know, the way that they bounced back from that as well also shows the character of this team. And we said earlier in the season, there was a couple games, and the Texas one in particular, like, hey, if one of those two guys that were there before, Sark, Giffen, they're probably not winning that game.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's been. You should also have to point out that, hey, there's a couple times where Helton's actually, because of him, they probably won, whereas someone prior to him would not have.
Yeah, like Shaw struggled with a Group of Five team in San Diego State, and they lost. USC struggled with a Group of Five team in Western Michigan, but they won. So at least they're winning. I think you have to get people kind of poo-poo it, but you got to give them credit for winning some of those close games. Curtis Moreno Valley. So we play Ohio State. Very talented, but sometimes don't play well, just like us. JT Barrett is not the runner Khalil Tate is. Not as good as throwing the ball either. I like the way KP showed blitz. I think he's talking about, maybe he meant CP, Clancy Pendergast. He put KP. Showed blitz for Stanford, then sometimes drop back into coverage to help the DBs. Smart move. Keep it up. Not super worried about this game. The Trojans will probably give us a heart attack, then pull out the win late in the fourth quarter. P.S., can we please recruit the best punt returner in the country? Our best punt returners just let the ball bounce and get out of the way. Dory Jackson spoiled us for 3 years, and we never participated, prepared for an important special teams component, Curtis Moreno Valley. I don't think there was a question in that, but interesting thoughts.
I mean, with Ohio State, I think JT Barrett's probably a better passer than Khalil Tate. Khalil Tate's got the deep ball, but that's about it. So that's going to put an onus on Clancy Pendergast to be more balanced with his attack, whereas some of these teams like Stanford, you make the young quarterback beat you, Whereas now JT Barrett was a guy that was a Heisman contender early in the season. He's a guy that can beat you with his legs and his arms. They have a very, very talented running back in J.K. Dobbins. So, you know, they're you know, Clay Helton even talked about it. His favorite word, they got offense balance. So it's going to put put the onus on Clemson Pendergast to come up with some things. And Clemson Pendergast has been a boomer bust type of coordinator. I mean, people might forget he gave up 63 points in that Arizona State game that you remember before the tarmac after the game. But when his game plans are working, you know, they're some of the best game plans out there. But when they don't, you know, they can be a lot of points put up pretty quickly.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, this one's kind of long. But I agree. Ohio State is like similar to USC. Is like they can play. They're a lot of talent, all the talent in the world. They're just like USC. And then some weeks they just play like crap, like the Iowa week and stuff. But it should be an interesting game. But yeah, one team could play really well, and the other team could play like crap, and it's like a blowout either way.
Yeah.
You hope they both play similar, and then it's like a good game.
You could get like the Rose Bowl last year, where both of them were both teams. You know, at the beginning, at the end, USC was the team was much better, and Penn State was playing awful. And then in between, you give up four touchdowns and four straight plays or whatever it was.
Yeah, so. Seven straight touchdown drives for Penn State, but then, like, nothing around it. Imani, okay, this is kind of long. The corruption within college football has completely turned me off to watching the games next year. ESPN has sold its soul to the SEC. Listening to them argue for both Alabama and Ohio State was sickening when the SEC played the championship during the BCS era. Many believe the college football playoff four teams would solve the above. Instead, the SEC gets two teams in while the other teams were physically killing themselves to win a conference championship game. Alabama gets to stay home, heal their wounds, eat popcorn, and get in. The Tide basically received two bye weeks. Does Saban own ESPN? You don't have to read this email on the air, but I am. I'm just expressing how I'm done with college football. Enjoy the bowl games and the four-team college playoff. I will not waste a minute of my time watching the games. P.S. Ohio State, USC, UCF, and any other conference champion deserve that fourth playoff spot. Not a team that did not win its division, let alone the conference. P.S. Again, ESPN should be ashamed of itself for the way it made a case for Ohio State and Alabama. I look forward to the day they're forced to shut down 50% of its operations when fans cancel their subscriptions. That's from Imani. They actually have a lot of layoffs over at ESPN, so there's some struggles. But he's boycotting college football, which I wouldn't do. I love college football.
Especially when you have a championship game like we did last year. So, you know, if there's a game like that, now the semifinal games were not very good last year. The championship game was worth every penny that you pay for your cable subscription. Does Nick Saban own own the ESPN? I mean, Nick Saban does a tremendous job. He knows when to be good with the media. He knows he doesn't have to be good with the local media. If you notice, like, he'll go off on guys. But then you also notice, like, he's doing walking around his house with Marty Smith, and he's walking, you know, doing special call-ins for ESPN. He knows how to play the media, and he has, you know, been the best at it for several years, I think, of knowing when to talk, when not to talk, and who he can be confrontational with as well. If you look back at the SEC media days, when it comes to the college football playoff, if you know how to sell yourself right, you're going to help yourself out, because you look at the football committee members, their athletic directors and stuff, they don't get to watch, 100 games every Saturday. They're not filling up their DVR with watching an Oklahoma State versus Iowa State game and, all these random games across the country. They're going to catch in, they're going to flip through, they're going to see clips of, the best games, and when they get to the top 5-10 teams, then they'll watch those games. But they're not watching all these games across the country. You have to sell yourself.
We had Steve from Beaumont kind of talking about the conferences stacking the decks, which we talked about already. Thanks for sending that one in, Steve. Scott in San Diego, he said, great win for the Pac-12. I'm currently watching other championship games. Can't help but notice the quality difference in the officiating for the Big 12 and the SEC championship game. There's no question who was running the game. The Pac-12 officials, by contrast, look like their hands are on the wheel and we're holding off for dear life. I'm not sure if Larry Scott addressed the officiating issues after the game, but he needs to be held accountable for the quality difference. Thanks for all you do, Scott in San Diego. Yeah, I was watching I think we were watching together the Oklahoma game. It was the middle of the second quarter, and there was a face mask, and they were like, that's the first penalty of the game. You're like, are you freaking kidding me? But yeah, we want to try to get through these, but yeah.
Which also tells you that a lot of stuff is not called in the SEC. It's a much more grabby conference in the trenches in particular. It's much more like the Stanford teams that you see.
Yeah. Robin in Virginia, Another one. Who would be your offensive defensive players of the game and why?
Oh, I you got to take Michael Pittman. I thought Michael Pittman should have been the MVP.
I think he could have been,
Sam Darnold. Nothing against Sam Darnold. But, and then defensively, it's hard not to look at that fourth down stop and the fact that Uchenna Nwosu has been so good all season. So I would go there. The other option is probably Chris Hawkins. I mean, career high 13 tackles. His grandmother had died less than 24 hours before. In fact, he's playing with a heavy heart and came out and made some big plays, including the first down stop on that fourth down goal line stand, making a tackle in the back backfield there.
Tyler and Sammamish, more about the officiating. We talked about that.
They're bad.
They're bad. Frank in Sacramento, he said, after the Pac-12 championship game, I raced home to watch a recording. Bryce Love fumbled the ball at the end of the first quarter, and Hilton should have challenged the call. Frank in Sacramento.
I believe when I rewatched it, they said on the broadcast, you cannot challenge forward progress. I don't think that's something, you know, once they mark forward progress down, I don't think that's something that can be challenged or can be overturned, which is why I don't think there was a review even of the referees there.
Yeah.
Or was there? I can't remember.
I don't think there was. Like, we thought there was going to be, but everyone on Twitter was saying, yeah, that's a fumble, that's a fumble. So, yeah, that was and that led to a touchdown. So
Stanford fumbled the ball six times.
Yeah.
The two that USC recovered, quote, air quotes there, were that one where the forward progress was marked, and the other one was reviewed and overturned to be a forward pass. Correct right. call on that one. But four times the ball was on the ground and USC couldn't come up with it. And in a couple times it was sitting there. I mean, I posted a couple pictures yesterday. The Rasheem Green one in particular, the ball seemed, I was shooting, you know, I'm looking at the ball through my camera lens. I'm like, it's just sitting there. It's just sitting there. It's just sitting there.
You put and up those
feels
pictures,
like,
yeah.
It feels like forever when you, you know, especially with a fumble, like it just seems like time standing still. But, you know, you look at the replay, the ball is like right beside Josh Fatu's foot. He doesn't see it though. And the guy that's blocking him actually falls like immediately, like he's playing a childhood game. He just immediately falls down on the ground and recovers the fumble. And the other one, the Uchenna Nwosu has the ball go through his hands.
Yeah.
And Bryce Love, you know, inside the 10-yard line on that one. I can't remember if that was the fourth down goal line stand as well. But the reviewed overturn of the incomplete pass, and then also Rasheem Green's were on the same drive, which was a touchdown drive. So there's two opportunities on that drive. You know, there's a couple opportunities inside the 10-yard line with the forward progress and the second Bryce Love fumble. You know, those are potential absolute momentum changers. That's why the game was close. That and the fact that Stanford was able to score right before halftime, those are the two main reasons why that was a close game. Or at USC, because of how well their offense was doing and how they were able to run the ball at will at times, you know, that, you know, USC outgained them by, I don't know, 100, 150 yards.
Right, yeah.
With that and the fact that there's some hidden yards and, like, the punt returns and stuff, you know, those were the two main reasons, though, why USC, you would expect when you outgain them by 150 or so yards, then you would be up by, you know, 14 points or at least.
All right. We're going to have to try to knock a few of these out. We only got, like, 5 minutes or so left.
I'll try.
Marcel and San Gabriel Valley. It appears our defense is built to stop the run, but they're just horrible against the pass. How do the numbers compare between now and when Justin Wilcox was the defensive coordinator? And what are the chances Ken Norton comes back to USC?
The difference in Clancy Pendergast is he's going to blitz and he's going to be aggressive. They're going to have negative plays there.
Negative plays.
Whereas Justin Wilcox was, you know, they were throwing, you know, they're killing USC with 6 yard hitches and, you know, 7, 8 yard. Just seemed like every play was 6, 7, 8 yards. And then they were just, you know, slowly going down the field.
Death by a million paper cuts.
Yeah, and USC never, it didn't seem like they ever got any pressure.
No.
So it's kind of two opposite types of
philosophies
and, you know, both of them can be good or bad.
Ken Norton's not coming back. He got fired by I don't think Ken Norton will be coming back to USC. He got fired by the Raiders. Let's see, JR in Albuquerque. Thank you for sharing your insights and opinions on the podcast. It feels good to be Pac-12 champions. With that being said, I had a question regarding the assistant coaches. Seeing our DBs get beat over and over, always out of position, confused, lost, etc. It has to be clear to most fans, and hopefully Clay, that a change is needed at DB coach. Offensive line is another key area of concern for the program moving forward. My question is, how much do we pay our DB position coaches? We don't know that. And what do other top blue blood programs like Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State pay their DB position coaches? And how does it compare to USC? My main concern is that Clay is not shown the ability yet to recruit top-tier position coaches from other great programs, which hurts our player development and recruiting. At the end of the year, too, Clay Helton, lack of player development in key positions is obvious. All the problems we have endured on the offensive line this year, last year, for example, I mostly attribute to poor position coaching and subpar recruiting due to constant turnover there the last 5 years. Does Will USC, quote-unquote, pay up for top-tier position coaches, and do they believe Clay Helton has the ability to snag talented position coaches and retain them for a while? JR in Albuquerque. Real quick, I love the Dylan McCullough hire. That's a great – I think they got to keep doing stuff like that. And I think they pay on par. I don't think – you know, I think T makes a lot of money. I think a bunch of the guys make a lot of money.
I think they do fine in that regard. The bigger question is the support staff. You know, there's not a ton of money there for that. But you look at the two main coaches that were not – already invested. Okay, Clay Helton, John Baxter, Neil Callaway, Tyson Helton all had previous relationships with them. Clancy Pendergast basically brought in Ronnie Bradford as his guy. Outside of those, you look, you got Johnny Nansen was kind of still on staff, so we'll not include him either. But Kenechi Udeze and Dylan McCullough are the two that Clay went out and found or, you know, located. These are the two guys. Now, Kenechi has connections with USC,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, I mean, he was a strength coach and stuff.
But those two guys are the probably the two biggest assistant coach stars on the staff. I think both of them have tremendously bright futures. So I don't think you can say, well, Clay isn't being able to go out and spot and find assistant coaches that are good. Now, will he make changes and try to go do that? That is a question.
Yeah. I think it's the whole initial staff when you're like all the circumstances of being hired and all that kind of stuff. The deal in McCullough, if things go that way, I think it's a positive thing for USC. If he's able to make changes in the offseason, like, you know what, now I got my guys, but I'm going to get rid of this guy, I'm going to bring him in, whatever it is, I think that would be a positive aspect. Steve, guys, why would ESPN totally ignore Rojo's first run of the night going over OJ? I don't know. I guess they didn't talk about it or something?
It was fast forwarding, so I didn't.
Yeah, it was announced in the press box and stuff, and we were all over social media. But I don't know.
My guess would be they didn't have a graphic ready, you know, inside.
But a lot of people were ready. They knew, like a lot of people knew, one run he could be over that. So, John in Oakland, on a recent podcast, there was a suggestion of hiring some of the recently fired coaches to be assistants. I agree with you that this would not be helpful. But what about bringing in one as an off-field consultant like Jim Mora? Similar to what Saban did with Sark, he could give Helton and the staff an outside perspective on the team, especially how the UCLA game is played against how UCLA game planned against USC. Keep up the great insight into Trojan football, John in Oakland. I think Sark's a very unique thing because of the way he had to be fired and all that stuff. So he was kind of like an untouchable coach. Like, Moore was just fired for performance, so it wasn't like – that's a very different thing.
Nick Saban has brought in several prior coaches for, you know, analyst positions and stuff. The question becomes, do the coaches want that type of thing? You know, USC would bring in, you know, every fired coach that they could and would love to get those insights. You know, Kevin Sumlin, I think, is a huge talent as far as intelligence, just watching him on some of those, you know, the college football playoff championship, they show
the coaches
room where they do the film and the coaches are talking about it. And I watch that every season. And Kevin Sumlin was the absolute star on you know, the two times I've seen him on it. You know, if you can bring him in, sure. Does Kevin Sumlin really want to come in and be an offensive analyst or whatever it may be rather than, hey, I'll get another coaching job? You know, that's the difficult part. You know, it's not going to – head coaches aren't going to go from – you know, this $4 or $5 million now is what head coaches are getting to be like, yeah, I'll be a $300,000 offensive assistant or whatever the pay is for those guys to analyze your game tape.
All right, we got a few more. We really got to do them quick. Huntington Harvey, it was kind of long. He was basically saying that no other college football program has an easier path to their conference title than USC. So he's saying that USC fans should expect more than just winning the conference. So he's one of the, I think he's kind of critical of Clay Helton. And I get that, but USC hadn't won it since 2008. That's the thing. And the South had never won it. So maybe it's easier or whatever for USC to do it, but I think you still got to give Clay Helton credit for winning it.
Yeah. And, you know, it ebbs and flows in every conference. You know, who's the power team, except in the Pac-12, USC's just been so dominant. I don't mean it's the easiest path. Look at Oklahoma right now. They have a pretty easy path in that regard, especially with Texas down right now.
Yeah. And so he's saying that the AD, everyone should push for changes for the staff and stuff like that. We'll kind of wait and see what happens. If they don't make any changes, I think that would be an area for concern.
Lynn Swann is not going to fire Clay Helton after a Pac-12 championship.
No, he's not. And he said he wouldn't force him to do anything on the staff. We'll see if that's true. Bill in Vegas, any talk about bringing Sammy Knight back as a DB coach? Haven't heard anything like that. Don't bring back former players that have not coached, like that aren't like. If you want a DB coach, get a really good DB coach. Don't bring a name you've heard. They've done that many times.
Sammy Knight has coached. I think he's in the NFL coaching. Last I heard, I don't remember. But they're not going to be. You're not going to hear a ton of names come out unless there's actual movement.
Yeah.
To get rid of coaches. So no, we haven't heard a ton of names about who they're looking at because those positions aren't open. The question will be that 10th coach. What does Clay Helton do with that?
Yeah, that's going to be a big addition. And then Don, last thing. We less knowledgeable, opinionated fans appreciate your wealth of knowledge and insight. Regarding Swan's Monday meetings with Helton, do you believe there are very general or possibly more detailed, such as questions about certain play calls? Swan came out and said he doesn't talk about that stuff. Since the play calling is shared by just about everyone, you think that Swan brings up certain plays? I know if I was AD, I would ask those questions to better gauge the performance of my staff. Difficult to analyze coaching personnel without knowing who is responsible for game plans and play calling. Clancy appears to be transparent, but the offensive side seems to be a mystery when it comes to who's responsible for what. T has gotten most of the blame, but quite possibly the questionable play calls may not have been his calls. Hey, Don, no, I agree with you on that, but just from talking to Lynn Swann after the game, he was sounding like, you know, I think he has high expectations. He wants him to win, but he's going to let Clay do his thing. Now, maybe behind the scenes, he's like, hey, you know, you need to get rid of this guy or do something. But he seemed like, from what he was saying, he's going to like, I'm going to hire the coach and let him do his thing. But he's going to have high expectations for what he wants him to do.
Yeah, it seems at least that he's being more CEO than, you know, trying to get his hands dirty, too. Like Pat Hayden, you know, was on the recruiting trail, I think, at one point.
Yeah.
Because they were down with staff members. So I don't think he's...
We heard Pat Hayden was, like, in on, like, offensive meetings and
very
stuff.
Very invested. Yeah. So yeah. I don't think Lynn Swann is quite as involved and meddling as much.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up because we have... it's about 12 minutes to the top of the hour. I got to edit this and get it up before we start our live show. So thanks, Shotgun, for coming in the studio and answering the questions. It's better than just me talking. It's nice to have you there.
Just trying to help you out.
Yeah. Nice. Well, okay. I hope you guys enjoyed this edition of the Peristyle Podcast. Make sure you check out our live show. The replay will be up on USAFootball.com. And then Shotgun and Keeley will be recording their Family Feud podcast a little bit later today. So that'll be going up as well. So lots of stuff. Hope you guys enjoyed it. And we will talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. Don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.